Hi everyone, we wanted to include a quick content warning for this episode regarding a discussion we have about something in today's film that can easily be interpreted as sexual misconduct. Thanks for listening.
On the Bechdel cast, the questions asked if movies have women in them. Are all their discussions just boyfriends and husbands, or do they have individualism? The patriarchy's effing vast. Start changing it with the Bechdel cast.
Hello and welcome to the Bechdel cast. My name is Caitlin Durante.
My name is Jamie Loftus. And this is our movie.
We made a movie.
This is our movie. Welcome to our movie. This is our podcast. It's been on for 4 years. I don't know why I said it was a movie.
Well, I thought you were going to say, like, this is our movie podcast.
This is our movie. Oh, I could have saved it in that way.
You could have just really seamlessly fixed it without anyone being any wiser.
Well, I only do one take. That's something I famously do. We're talking about Ghost World today on our podcast, which is about movies that it's been on for many years.
Oh, our podcast is about, I thought you meant the Ghost World is about movies.
I just got out of a lobotomy, so that's why I'm sounding this way.
It's difficult. It's a difficult day.
500 degrees today. My brain is just boiling in my head. Is this a podcast? This is a podcast.
It's a podcast about movies in which we examine the story through an intersectional feminist lens. Mm-hmm. It's inspired by the Bechdel test.
By queer cartoonist Alison Bechdel, sometimes called the Bechdel-Wallace test, mm-hmm. that requires, for our purposes, that two characters that are not coded male with names speak to each other about something other than a coded male character for two lines of dialogue. Doesn't happen a lot.
Yeah.
But it does happen.
Should we test it out?
Yeah, let's do it.
Hey, Jamie.
Yes, Caitlin.
Yep, no, I was going to pull a quote from the movie and nothing fits, so never mind.
That's okay, I have no problem with that. And that passes the test.
Yep.
Things that aren't good dialogue pass the test all the time.
It's true. Let's introduce our guest.
Yes.
She is the creator and star of Difficult People. She is the co-host of Double Threat Podcast. It's Julie Klausner.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi. Welcome. Hello. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here.
Absolutely.
So we're talking about Ghost World. Julie, what's your relationship with this movie?
I love Ghost World. This is one of my favorite movies, and I'm excited to talk about it in the context of the Bechdel test, because the film itself was so dramatically different from the book source material. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people have, you know, take great issue in the focus of the film being on the relationship between Enid and Seymour as opposed to Enid and Rebecca. And mm-hmm. I completely understand that. I think of them as two completely different works, but I think it's really interesting to talk about that in the context of female coded characters speaking to each other about mm-hmm. things besides a man or a crush. And while I think that, you know, this is definitely a step in the in the failure of that test direction, I just think it's such an outstanding movie in its own right, exclusive of the source material, that I'm just always excited to talk about Ghost World.
So are you familiar with the source material? Have you read the comics?
Yes.
Oh, cool. Okay.
Nice. That's helpful for us.
Don't quiz me, because also I didn't rewatch this for the podcast. I just figured I've seen it so many times that I'll, you know.
For sure.
Just don't quiz me. I'm going to fail. You know what? Fuck it. Quiz me. No. Let's do it. Quiz me. I'm ready. Let's do it.
On page 47.
Oh, fuck you. Come on. Come on. How dare you?
Jamie, what's your relationship with this film?
Very short. I had not seen this movie before. I don't know. It's been recommended to me for years and years, and it was just one of those movies that I had not gotten around to seeing. And it's like one of those movies that when I finally did watch it, I don't know what I thought it was about, but it's not, whatever it was, it is not what the movie is actually about. I feel like there's a ton to talk about here.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm very conflicted. Like, I think that if I had seen this movie when it came out and or like when I was a teen, I would feel probably different about it than just coming in to watch it for the Bechdel cast.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I'm excited to talk about it. What about you, Caitlin? Had you seen this before?
I had. I saw it, I think, when I was a freshman in college. And that would have been a few years after it came out. That would have been in like 04, 05. I was about the same age as the characters. And I was also going to be like, I'm sure if I had seen this when it came out, I would feel differently about it. But I kind of did see it at that age. And I do not, I can't say that I like this movie. And I have reasons.
I also am not a fan of this movie. I don't know. I mean.
But I know its value. And I, oh, so, it, okay. So it's a huge, it's a big cult classic.
Yes.
It is very meaningful and very valuable to a lot of people, such as yourself, Julie. I want to acknowledge that. But again, yeah, I think because like Jamie and I, we're watching it mostly through the lens of our podcast, it's there's some issues.
Oh, certainly. Yeah. There's some issues even not. There's issues exclusive of the podcast. Absolutely.
True.
Right. Yeah, I think the thing that bumped me the most on this watch and like analysis of it was how much this movie attempts to deal with race for an exclusively white cast and like in front of the camera and behind. Like it's just. It just,
this is the whitest movie on earth. No, there's no race in this world. There's no race in this world.
But
no.
It also tries to address race through like a lot of different plot it points shouldn't. And
That's
side plots. It shouldn't. Yeah, correct. I guess what I'm saying is it is very bizarre. I think the most surprising thing to me about the story, like I was like, okay, I'm sure that it will be dated in a number of ways in the way it treats its characters, but I was surprised that this movie even attempted to address race and felt
you mean
that
in terms of
job.
the poster of the old poster
yeah
that Seymour yeah. has. I think that's more about the lens of like a white person dealing with what art is, because after this he made Art School Confidential, which is about being an artist in, you know, art school, obviously.
Yeah.
And that sort of debate that you have internally, these four walls and how different that is from the world outside. But the race of it, I think, is just a total prop for the white characters to have a point of departure. It could have been almost anything.
Right,
which means like it shouldn't have been race.
Yeah, it's like so they should have just. I feel like they just should have chosen something else that they were qualified to tackle.
They could have chosen anything else that's from olden times that's not okay. Absolutely,
and we'll talk more about that in a little bit. But should I just dive into the story and we'll go from there?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right, so we meet Enid and Rebecca, played by Thora Birch and Scarlett Johansson, respectively. Mm-hmm. They are graduating from high school. They are a little...
They're not like the other girls.
They're a little counterculture.
They're not like the other girls.
They think that everything sucks, which I personally can relate to. So in that way,
yeah,
I get it.
It's peak like 17-year-old, which is in a way that is like sometimes painful to look at.
Sure.
Yeah.
Enid discovers that she has to go to summer school and retake an art class. We learn just a little bit about their backstories as well. They are not going to go to college. They plan to just enter the workforce and get an apartment together and move in together. Then they see an ad in the personal section for a guy who is looking for this striking blonde woman who he had met at an airport shuttle, and he thought he had a connection with her.
Mm-hmm.
So they call him to more or less prank him. They pretend to be the striking blonde and tell him to go to this diner called Wowsville.
Which is great.
Love it. Great name. So Enid and Rebecca wait for him there, and they bring their friend Josh, played by Brad Renfro, who will find that like Enid maybe has a crush on, and so does maybe Rebecca, not totally sure.
Not totally clear. And then I don't know, there's some context for that too in like the ways that studios were trying to push this script to go. There's versions of this script where he takes on way more significance than he does in the version that was released.
Mm-hmm. And then the man from the ad shows up to Wowsville, and you'll never believe who it is.
It's Steve Buscemi.
Steve Buscemi. And he sits there, he waits, and they take pity on him and decide to follow him home.
He is selling records at a garage sale because he's a record collector and he's a music enthusiast. And they decide to go talk to him. They find out his name is Seymour. Rebecca thinks he's a loser, but Enid is like, I don't know, I think he's kind of cool. Mm-hmm. So Enid listens to the record that she had bought from him. She really likes it. She goes back to see him and they talk about music. And then she and Rebecca go to a party at Seymour's. David Cross is there and he tries to hit on Rebecca. And then Seymour is like, Enid, I can't believe you came to this party. I'm such a loser. I haven't even had a girlfriend in 4 years. And she's like, well, I'll help you find a girlfriend. And then meanwhile, we see Enid in her art class. Mm-hmm. We see her teacher criticizing her art projects that she brings in.
Her teacher hates cartoons.
Yes.
You draw a cartoon. This is like Daniel Clowes, like grinding a very personal axe. And I think a very obvious way where he's like, you know, how art teachers think cartoons are fucking stupid. Well, guess what? They're not. Like, that's kind of his whole axe to grind in the beginning of this storyline. If you draw a cartoon, you suck. So I guess he had a teacher that felt that way at some point and he's not over it.
Right.
Yeah.
Because the teacher in this movie is often telling Enid that her projects are not thoughtful or political enough. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, Rebecca has gotten a job at a coffee shop. We will see Rebecca kind of becoming, adhering more and more to like societal conventions and expectations, in that she starts dressing a little bit more kind of conventionally, and she gets a job and she wants to have her own home and things like that, while Enid is still sort of trying to live the counterculture life. Mm-hmm. And then Enid and Seymour go to a bar to watch music, and she tries to set him up with this random woman there. It doesn't work out. And then they go back to Seymour's house, and she finds this old poster from a chicken fast food restaurant where he works as an assistant manager at their corporate headquarters. And this poster shows a very racist name and image that the restaurant used to like use. So she takes it with her, this poster, and brings it into her art class as a found art project. Mm-hmm. And she says that with this piece, she's making a statement about racism and how it's whitewashed in our culture. And everyone in the class is like, wow, that's pretty fucked up. But the teacher is like, wow, what a remarkable achievement. Mm-hmm. Then we see Enid celebrating Seymour's birthday with him. And while this is happening, he receives a call from the real striking blonde woman who he had placed the ad about.
Dana.
Dana, yep. Yeah. Enid convinces him to call her back, and he meets her. And they turned out to not have anything in common, but they start seeing each other anyway, to Enid's dismay. Mm. Now, meanwhile, her art piece of the racist poster is put on display at a student art show, but people are demanding its removal. Enid isn't even there to defend herself because she goes over to Seymour's and she's like, hey, let's hang out. And he's like, I don't think it's a good idea that we hang out anymore.
And it's like, okay, this is just occurring to him now.
Yes. And it's like,
he's like, wait, hold on. I'm Steve Buscemi and my best friend is 17. The optics of this are not so good.
Yes, another huge issue I take with this film.
It's very bizarre, yeah.
And then she's like, okay, fine, I won't bother you anymore. And then Rebecca is like, hey, you clearly don't want to live with me anymore, so fuck you. Enid also loses out on her scholarship opportunity for this art academy. So this is what we would call the low point of the film. And she's sad, so she goes over to Seymour's again. And she's like, how come you never asked me out when I was trying to find you a girlfriend? What if I just move in with you? And he's like, shrug. And then they have sex.
Which I truly did not think was going to happen.
Was going to happen?
In the movie. I didn't think it was going to happen. And then there it is and it happens. And I was just like, oh, okay. And then Steve Buscemi pivots so many times. he's like, we shouldn't hang out anymore because you're 17. He's like, I thought about it and we should actually get married because you're 17. I'm like, okay, Steve Buscemi.
Yep. And then so Enid seems to regret this decision to have sex with him immediately and starts blowing him off. and then decides to move in with Rebecca again. Meanwhile, Seymour finds out from Rebecca about the prank that they played on him at the beginning of the movie. Mm-hmm. And he thinks that she is in love with Josh, their friend who shows up every 45 minutes.
Right.
So Seymour goes to confront him, ends up in the hospital. Enid comes to visit Seymour in the hospital and she apologizes and she's like, actually, you're my hero. You're the coolest person I know. But then Enid leaves. It seems like, although she and Rebecca have made up, their kind of lives are headed on different paths. Mm-hmm. We see Seymour in therapy. He's talking about his breakup with Enid. And then Enid gets on a bus that is out of service, and it might be a metaphor for her dying.
It's a metaphor. The whole metaphor bus guy that you're like, oh, right, this was a book first.
Yes.
Metaphor bus equals it was a book.
So that's the story. Let's take a quick break and then we will come right back to discuss.
One of the things that stood out to me about this movie was what you were saying earlier, Julie, was that I thought that this movie was going to be way more about Enid and Rebecca, but Scarlett Johansson is actually not in this movie that much.
No.
Yeah.
Rebecca's not a very fleshed out character in the movie.
Mm-mm. Yeah. It's interesting because I wish that, and I'm assuming in the books that there was more focus on Rebecca, because this movie, I mean, it's not really taking the side of either one of them on their approach to life. And I kind of appreciate that. It's like, okay, they are taking different paths and that is neither a good nor a bad thing. But it is so like, just, I don't know. There's so much about this movie that you're just like, oh, 17 year olds are so frustrating, where like Enid is constantly mad at Rebecca of like, how dare you have a job to support. And I'm like, you fucking brat. I just got so frustrated with Enid every step of this movie. Cause she is very isolated by her own, you know, by her own mentality and by her own approach to life. Mm-hmm. But then it's like, there's so much like privilege tied up in the ways that she's frustrating. Like, she's mad that her friend has to have a job to survive, which is like, mm-hmm. Yeah, that's frustrating for everybody, but more so the people doing it than their friends. And mm-hmm. Like, I don't know. Yeah. I don't really know enough about Rebecca to really be attached to her, but of the two, I was team Rebecca.
Team Rebecca.
Yeah. Team grow up and get a life.
Sure. Again, like, I see the value in this movie in that, yeah, there weren't that many thoughtful or subversive portrayals of teen girls in media at this time. And I think that's why a lot of people latched on to it so much. And again, I appreciate what it's doing. In many ways, I relate to Enid and
totally.
Rebecca. Like, I was similar to them in some ways when I was a teenager. There are other ways in which I can't and don't relate to them, but isn't sure. that the way with characters? For me, it's just like, as subversive as it is, the things that it tries to subvert, in many cases, it mishandles.
It's hard because I was thinking a little bit about when we, and they're extremely different movies, but I guess as an example of when we talked about Carrie a couple of years ago, where that is like the experience of a teen girl in a very different genre, but it's told through the lens of so many different people who did not and could not possibly share the experience of a teen girl, yeah, that it all kind of like, it feels like there are things that are true and relatable and like very emotionally poignant about it. But then it kind of gets lost because it's like, okay, you know, a man originally wrote this book and then a different man. They're both, you know, I'm sure emotionally sensitive and wonderful people, but there's some stuff that just feels a little off and rings a little hollow. And I think that part of it can be attributed to that, mm-hmm, where it's like too.
Wait, Brian De Palma is not a sensitive person.
No, I just
want to get that in there.
But as far as like Terry and Daniel go, they seem to be like a well-intentioned writing team that want to portray these experiences honestly. But I just kind of wish that they had like spoken to and credited more women in that process, and the whole work probably would have been elevated if that were the case. The same thing goes for the, I think, kind of big misses they make with the comments they try to make on race. It's like, you know, it's just they are not qualified to be making these statements. And I think that where it does succeed is where they're trying to communicate how clueless both Enid and Seymour are about racism and how they are saying a lot of things but clearly not understanding them, to the point where Enid is literally trying to like advance herself off of the work of other people and off of the idea of racism without really doing any critical thinking or introspection about it.
Mm-hmm.
And that reads pretty clearly. But then what? Like, you have to have a black person involved in the production and you have to have a black character. Otherwise, you're just saying like, I don't understand racism. Here it is. Here. Like, I don't know. It just doesn't. It just felt very strange to me.
I agree. I think, too, that so the comic book was written by Daniel Clowes. He co-wrote the screenplay with Terry Zwigoff, who directed the film. So that those are our people who are telling this story. I feel like this is another case of like men observing women in the world and thinking, I get it. I see how women be. So I'll tell their story. And to me, we see a lot of this like, you know, these girls are not like the other girls, which I want to clarify something about that. Because every time I teach my screenwriting class, my students are always like, I just want to make sure my girl isn't like one of the girls who's not like the other girls. And I'm like, because I think it can maybe be easily misinterpreted. What we take issue with is the idea that a woman will behave a certain way because she does not want to be perceived as being like other women, because other women equals bad, because like femininity or womanhood or anything like that is a negative thing.
Right.
And they're trying to disassociate themselves with that. That is what we mean by this when we comment on this trope.
Right.
And this is kind of what the characters are doing, especially in how they view other female characters in this movie, because even though Enid and Rebecca have a what feels like a strong relationship at first, although it deteriorates over the course of the movie.
Right.
There are various other characters, like a classmate of theirs named Melora, who just seems to want to hang out with them.
So sweet.
And they're like, she's so awful. Enid hates her, like, I guess, former stepmom or like an ex-girlfriend of her dad's who he starts dating again. We're not really sure why she hates her.
I think the way that the art teacher and the star art student is also kind of telling too, where it's like the star art teacher is very, I mean, again, I'm just like, I think that it genuinely is Daniel Clowes grinding some old acts that he has from high school. But it is, it's like this woman who only wants to see art about like abortion and vagina. And the student who gets rewarded is I think she's like made out to be this overly serious artist who only makes things about abortion and vagina, and that is rewarded. And so it's like, yeah, the way that other women are characterized, it is a little like, you know, Enid and Rebecca are the outliers. What I do appreciate is that Enid and Rebecca are clearly flawed, and it's made clear to the audience that their way of life is not sustainable or like quote unquote right. But it is given the most focus.
Right.
I don't know.
I think, like, kind of piggybacking off of that, the way that feminism is represented in the movie is made to seem, like, foolish and, like, that feminists are ridiculous because, like, the art that this student is making, that the teacher is really praising, is, like, feminist art that's pro-choice and that's, you know, about their, let me find the quote here, it's something about a shocking image of repressed femininity.
Right.
And then there's also this moment where Rebecca, they're looking for apartments in like the newspaper. And she's like, oh, here's one. Oh, wait a minute. You'd have to live with a feminist and her two cats. So
it's weird because it's like, I understand what they're critiquing. And it is kind of funny in moments where it's like, I feel like the art teacher character and the star art student are critiquing like the overly serious art world of like, here's a cup and it symbolizes this serious issue. And I get that is silly and like it is funny to poke fun at that mentality, but it does seem to, but the again, it's similar to the fact that they choose race as a topic to make this critique they're not qualified to make. It doesn't quite read very well for like two straight male artists in collaboration to be like, we're going to poke fun at feminist art specifically. Like, why, mm-hmm. why is that the art they specifically choose to pick on? There's so much overly serious art that you could, you know, choose and tell a more effective joke. I don't know.
Yeah, for sure. Well, Julie, curious, because we so far we've only heavily criticized the movie.
Just, like, shit on your...
What was it that drew you to this movie, into this story and these characters? Like, why?
I was exactly like Enid in high school. Yeah. I've never seen a character that's more represented exactly who I was at that age mm-hmm. and at that point in my life. And I find it to be such a true representation of what it's like when the person that you fit in with because you're on the outskirts of everything is no longer someone that you can connect to, and how completely rootless that is. And during those transitional moments, like the summer between high school and college, being lost and then everyone else seemingly, you know, just falling into place and not feeling like you have anywhere to go, and your sexuality is like overwhelming. You know, she talks about like being so horny and hating everyone at the same time, which I think is such a like a perfect encapsulation of that particular age where you're like, fuck you, get away from me, but also fuck me because I'm desperate to connect. that she looks forward in other places, such as like connecting with Seymour and, you know, trying to do things with her art and her work and her sketchbook. But at the end, she doesn't fit in anywhere. She doesn't fit into the art world. The Seymour thing she realizes was like misguided, and she feels gross about. She can't go home anymore because Maxine is back, and she has a, you know, kind of a strange relationship with her sort of semi-cuckolded father to begin with. And we don't know what her history was with Maxine, but it was ugly. We don't know where her real mom is. Mm-hmm. And then she just stopped connecting to Rebecca. And I've been in friendships like that, where you have this best girlfriend and it's you against the world. And then one day things are just different. And she wants to like pick tumblers at Crate and Barrel. And you're like, I am not on board. We used to sit at diners and make fun of everything together. And right. there's these beautiful little hat tips to, you know, the times that they spent so much time together in high school and all of the things that they've been through. And one of them is when Enid is doing that like little tag sale in her front yard. And Rebecca's like, oh, I remember this. This is from your little old lady phase.
Yeah.
Right.
And of course, Enid like had a phase where she was dressing like a little old lady. And of course, Rebecca was there for it. Rebecca's definitely always been like the sort of beta friend. Enid is definitely the more colorful of the two. It's definitely Enid's story that Rebecca's sort of always been like riding sidecar on. Mm-hmm. At a certain point, like they stop connecting, or Rebecca realizes that she wants to drive the car, and Enid suddenly fits nowhere. And she fulfills her fantasy of getting on a bus out of town and disappearing because she doesn't know where else to go or what else to do.
Yeah, and I think those are effective themes to explore in terms of like identity and where do I belong and who am I and who do I want to be now that I'm freshly an adult.
And like watching them fuck it up and like, you know,
yeah, it's not ready to be an adult because she can't get rid of that toy and the right. little tag sale.
Goofy
she's
guess.
Not ready. She's not ready to move on, but she doesn't want to go back either.
Yeah.
Right.
And I think, I mean, well, here's where the quiz comes in, because I imagine that this is, and you hinted at this, but I imagine this is what more the comic books are like, a focus on the friendship between Enid and Rebecca.
Yes.
To me, a more interesting movie would have been an exploration of that kind of deteriorating friendship. And you know, as you grow apart and you discover your interests and your priorities. And if they don't align with the person you thought was your best friend, like, how do you reconcile that?
It's so sad. And there's like the last panel and that, I mean, first of all, you're going to love the book because the book's just like all that. And her sort of seeing Rebecca having moved on and saying like, you've become such a beautiful young woman. And it is heartbreaking, like, to watch a friendship dissolve like that. It's just so specific. That is not what the movie is. And I do think that a lot of that has to do with casting. I think Scarlett Johansson's incredibly talented. I don't think that she really breathed that much life into this particular character. And so much of that is how it's written and directed, obviously. But you get Steve Buscemi attached, you're going to want to hang out with Steve Buscemi. And also the chemistry between the two of them and that relationship being as weird as it was. And also, I'm coming from a background where I've had relationships like that where I was very precocious and I was hanging out with older men that were really interesting to me, even though they were nerds and weird and didn't fit in. And they were like, why are you interested in me? You're so young. And I was like, I don't really know. I just am looking for a friend at this point in my life because I'm just trying to figure out where I belong because I don't feel like I belong anywhere. And part of it is tied up in sexuality, but another part of it is just because you're reconciling something that's gone, even though you need it so badly. And it's like the breakup of your best friend and taking these leaps that you're just not ready to take. So the movie, like I said, it's completely different. I love both of them, but everything, I think a lot of what you're describing can be like met with the comic book.
Good to know.
It makes me want to check out the comic because I do have like more interest in their friendship than I really do. I mean, even though it's like I totally like understand the dynamic that like exists between Enid and Seymour, and it's like if you haven't had a friendship like that yourself, you know someone who has, and it's very complicated and bizarre and worth exploring. But it's just the way it takes over this story. And when I was doing some research on the production, I guess that the way that the writing was split up was that Daniel Clowes focused on writing the friendship portions, and then Terry Zwigoff focused on Enid and Seymour because Seymour was kind of an avatar for him, where like every record that Seymour has is Terry Zwigoff's record, and like he designed Seymour's space because it was kind of a projection of himself.
Yeah, no, Terry Zwigoff is not like putting himself out there being like, I can tell other people's story. Like he literally holds up a copy of Terry Zwigoff's band, the Cheap Suit Serenaders, and he's like, is that one any good? And he's like, no, and it's a hilarious joke. But you know, it's very clear like who he is and what he's connected to. But I don't know anything about splitting up the script. That's new to me.
Yeah, that's the production, as I was able to find, was, I mean, obviously they collaborated on the final product, and it wasn't like this scene was written by Daniel, this scene was written by Terry, but as far as like developing the story, those were kind of where their focuses lied. Where, I mean, like it sounds like Daniel Clowes was kind of continuing to develop the book portion, and then Terry Zwigoff was expanding on a subplot that kind of ends up taking up the bulk of the movie. And I think their friendship is really complicated. And some things that like resonated with me that I like are in there, and I kind of wish were explored a little more, were like Rebecca and Enid have this really, really close friendship, but you still see those like little resentments that pop up in a friendship that close, where there's certain moments where like Rebecca is being flirted with by someone and Enid gets kind of annoyed and like is like, fuck this, like I'm not here for this. And like there's some tension that exists between them with Brad Renfro's character. Like there's little moments where it felt very authentic to like a teen friendship where you're like, I love you and you are my entire life, but like fuck this, and
but
like,
I also hate you right now
right for like this moment I'm so pit. Like that stuff is great. And I feel like there's kind of a tendency sometimes to flatten out friendships like that and be like, girl, friendships are perfect. They have no flaws. They're blah, 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 which is obviously not true. Mm-hmm. And it was cool to see that represented and to see the like way you grow apart from people in this like really painful, confusing way shown. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess I just need to read the book because that was what I was more interested in.
Yeah, because instead the movie focuses on the movie quickly shifts focus to the relationship between Enid and Seymour, which let's take a quick break and then we'll come back to discuss it.
And we're back. Should we just jump into the Steve Buscemi stuff?
Yes.
The Buscemi section of the podcast?
Yes.
Someone pointed this out to us on, I think it was Twitter, that so Julie, we use this metric that I made up called the Buscemi test, which is basically just if you sub in a like traditionally hunky guy with Steve Buscemi, is the interaction normal or is it way creepier?
For example, in The Notebook,
yes,
when Ryan Gosling is heavily pursuing Rachel McAdams and basically threatening to kill himself on a Ferris wheel unless she goes out with him, sub in Steve Buscemi Ryan Gosling, and if suddenly it's creepy,
sure.
And someone pointed out to us, they're like, I think that Ghost World fails this very Steve Buscemi related test, and I'm inclined to agree. This movie,
what do you mean? How does it fail that?
Well, I think that Steve Buscemi in this movie is playing a kind of creepy character at times, and that it
yes
reads that way. I don't know. I think that
yeah. I mean, for me, I don't know about everybody else. I take a lot of issue with this relationship between Enid and Steve Buscemi.
Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, look, the last scene is the most humiliating retribution that he's like. His mother's picking him up from therapy and like she's asking him what he wants for dinner and rolling his eyes and they shut the door. That's humiliating. That character gets comeuppance that I frankly like. I love Seymour and I love Buscemi's Seymour. I'm not saying that like it's okay to like, you know, be him and you know have had sex with Enid, but I also like I don't think he's like a villain by any stretch.
I also don't think that
the movie doesn't dodge him being creepy. I think it's like very, very open about that.
Yeah, I guess I get kind of lost in where the movie is trying to have you land on that, because there are moments where it's obviously like Enid fucks with a lot of people and manipulates a lot of people and makes a ton of mistakes, and Seymour is very affected by these manipulative choices she's making. But I did feel like the fault fell pretty heavily on her of like, how dare you be so like manipulative towards this sad man, as if like Steve Buscemi is not, you know, whatever, 45 years old in this and can't.
Wait, so you think the movie's like cutting him a break for what he's doing?
I think a little bit.
It feels
yeah.
that to me as well.
Yeah. I mean, I think he's definitely like a sympathetic character. Like, I think that like as an audience member, you're definitely like falling in love with Seymour. But in my opinion, that's because I think this is Enid's story and she's the protagonist and she's the person that you're meant to align with. So when she's falling in love with Seymour, you're kind of falling in love with Seymour. And then you fuck him and the next day you're like, what the fuck did I do? And then you realize like, oh my God, he is so much older and he doesn't have like the same frame of reference to me that like sex could be something that's like something that is meaningful, and he takes it the wrong way and he gets obsessed, which happened, and that just was like, what did I fucked up? From her point of view, just knowing that like he's a mess, and she's like, I should have known that the whole time. But I don't think it's saying that she's doing anything wrong and that he's like an innocent, vulnerable person necessarily.
I guess for me, it's not made clear enough one way or the other. My whole thing is the age gap here. She is presumably 18 because she's just graduated.
Yeah.
Although some people are still 17 when they graduate high school. I like turned 17 or I turned 18 on the day that I graduated. So like either way, she's barely out of high school. Her emotional brain is still developing. And then she's befriending this man who is...
But that's all her decision. She's the leader of that. That's her choice.
Yes, but I think that if you're a 40-something-year-old man and an 18-year-old young woman is trying to befriend you and initiates sex with you, you got to run the other way.
Well, she finally does. At the very end, she does. But mostly, they're just friends. And it's like a little
even
weird.
Even so,
sure.
Like, I don't know. I think...
I feel like it is kind of on, and I guess that part of where I really started to, like, Seymour started to lose me was when you see his friends as well, and you're like, oh, this is just a creepy group. Like, this is a...
Yeah, but he's better than those guys. He's better
but
than those
is
guys. When that dude, yes, because when that scene with his neighbor who, like, farted and he was like, thanks for the talk. I think you're setting him up to see, like, he's from this world, and there's a lot of people around him that fucking suck. But like, I think with the right like people around him, he could be, as you say, like different from the others.
I don't know. I think when you're a 40-year-old man, and even though, like, she's arguably cooler than him, and, like, it's
she's
not
absolutely
as,
cooler it, than him. Yeah.
Right. And it's not as though he has, like, fame or clout that he's exploiting to sleep with her. But to me, like, with an age gap like that, and it's not even the concept of an age gap that I take issue with. Like, if he were 50 and she were, 27, I would notice, but I wouldn't think much of it. It's the fact that she is a teenager and her emotional maturity still needs at least a few years of development. Like, even just looking at the way she meets Seymour, she plays this really childish and immature prank on him. Like, that's how they meet. And then, like, yeah, just overall, with their current ages and that situation, there's an imbalance in that dynamic. There's a certain power that comes with...
I couldn't agree more. I think the film is totally acknowledges that.
I mean, and like the fact that they don't end up together is yeah. better.
Not
than,
only they not end up together, he's punished.
He's punished. She gets on a death bus, maybe. Who knows what?
No. She's not dead. She okay. just leaves town. Yeah, yeah. She's leaving town. She's disappearing.
Yeah, I feel as though the movie doesn't challenge this relationship enough. I think that...
Well, and I think that a reason that may be is because the character that, like, we're talking about is a stand-in for the person making the movie. So that may be one of the reasons that it doesn't come down.
I think that Enid is the protagonist. I think that the creator's aligned with Enid, for sure.
I mean, Enid's definitely the protagonist.
Yeah.
Even so, it's... I don't know.
I still feel like, I mean, even though Enid is the protagonist, I just... The amount of sympathy that the movie dishes out for Seymour was like...
So you don't like Seymour at all?
I do. The thing is, like, I don't dislike Seymour. I appreciate the way he's painted. I appreciate that it's made clear that he is an insecure guy.
Yeah.
He feels like he's at a dead end in life. He doesn't have a lot
and
of people.
He's not like trying to fuck her. Like I think he's just like, okay, you're like my friend now, but what the hell would she like? It doesn't even occur to him. Like, what would you even want with me?
I guess that just wasn't my read of it. I believe that they are friends and they have a connection that is not explicitly sexual. But I do feel like Caitlin, like you were saying, that it's like him as someone who's, you know, whatever, 2.5 times her age. Yes. It's on him to make a clear
to not
boundary.
Be friends with her.
Yeah. To not engage it.
So he shouldn't have been friends with her.
Yes,
really?
I think so. Yeah.
All right.
He's been working at Cook's Chicken for longer than she's been alive. Like,
yeah, but they have something in common and they're both incredibly lonely.
I don't know.
The thing is, like,
I've had friendships with people that were much older than me at that age, and I didn't feel like they were sexually predatory. I felt like I was so desperate for connection that I was, and this was before the internet, I was looking for people that, like, I could talk to about anything because I just hated everyone so much, and the people around me just couldn't connect to. And I wanted to find some version of someone that maybe I could one day be.
I mean, I don't have an issue with them being friends per se. Like, I think that, but where the story lands, like, that's why I was so frustrated when he does say, okay, let's have sex, let's do this. Because
yeah,
I,
but he
I
never really
does.
Like, he's
him,
he resists but... the whole time. Like, he's like, everything she does that's sexual embarrasses him. Like, putting on the mask in that, like, X-rated, like, video shop and, like,
but then he still has sex with her and says he'll drop everything to, you know, marry her. So it's like,
well, that's because
him.
He loses his mind. He loses his mind. So she comes over and she's like, have sex with me. And then the next morning he like loses his mind. Because I also get the sense that Seymour hasn't had sex for like 30 years.
Well, I guess that if it was explicitly like a friendship between an older person and a younger person that there wasn't a trace of sex to be found. I mean, I'm not saying that older people can't be friends with younger people.
Sure.
Like, I've had older friends when I was a teenager too. Like, that's all good.
Right.
But the fact that, you know, for a lot of the movie, I was like, what is this friendship? And I was trying to figure out what is this friendship? And then where it goes, I feel like speaks to the fact that there was something vaguely sexual about it the whole time, because that's how it pays off. And then all of a sudden, he's going to drop everything to stay.
Well, yeah,
he loses
his mind. He loses his mind.
So
and he pays the price for it, for sure.
Yeah, but Jamie, I think you're like, there's always some like sexual undercurrent with just with the fact that she's like, I'm going to help you find a girlfriend.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Bring me to this sex shop. No one is like, I've wanted to go forever and no one's been able to take me, which does that imply that she's not old enough to go into a sex shop? Like, why
I don't
does
know.
She
when you were a teenager, didn't you want to go into those sex shops and be like, oh my God, I can't believe this dildo, and like laugh about it with your friend?
Yeah. Well, that's kind of why, again, I was like, oh, I wish that there was more Enid and Rebecca, because Rebecca is so frustrated when Enid, like, Rebecca's like, wait, you went without me? And Enid's like, yeah, well, you have a job.
They used to try to do that shit together. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. And now, like, they're not connecting. Yeah.
That's something that I totally did with my friends. And like, but
totally.
But it's like, you know, it's Seymour is the adult in this situation, and he doesn't have to be the guy that's like, oh no, this is so awkward for me, but I guess I'll go in. It's like he has to be the one to draw the boundary, I guess, and he doesn't have the ability to do it.
I understand. I've seen like and this is not an excuse to be like, I've seen so much worse, but like the power balance between the two of them is way more fluid than it is in something like Manhattan.
Sure. Yeah,
and she's definitely like the higher status partner the whole time, and I don't want to sound like shitty, but like I think she definitely comes over and like kisses him, like I'm not gonna say like seduces him as much as she decides when she goes over there, I'm going to kiss him, I'm going to like, I want to make out with Seymour. That's, to me, there's no question that she shows up and that's where she is at, and I don't think he would have ever initiated that with her. I really don't.
Sure, she does initiate basically every aspect of their
the relationship. They're on her terms. Absolutely. Yes.
Even so, just the whole the imbalance, even though it's not necessarily that exploitative, arguably on his end, there's still a just, you know, the experience and the wisdom and the perceptions you gain along the way of being older, and he has that and she doesn't, and there's no substitute. She can't read a book or, you know, listen to a record and then suddenly be wiser like she had, like she he has.
So if they hadn't fucked, would you be fine with it?
I would be better with it, but the fact that they end up having sex, just like, just Enid not knowing that it's a bad idea to pursue this man as a potential romantic partner that's like 20 plus years older than her, when she is, again, just freshly graduated from high school, like, that is proof that she doesn't have the wisdom and experience and emotional maturity that she would need to be his equal. And why doesn't Seymour think it's a bad idea to be hanging out with a teenager? Well, he's
lonely and wants to feel cool and all this stuff.
Well, and she's also very persistent. Like, it's very clear that she won't leave him alone.
But I don't know. Anytime she was like, take me to the sex shop. Girlfriend, let's get you a girlfriend. Let's get you. And he should have been like, this is inappropriate. We need to draw a boundary here. And the fact that it just goes on.
Yeah, but Seymour should have also drawn that boundary, like, before he moved in with his mom again. Like,
I mean, I did like that they show at the end that he, like, realizes that, you know, he had crossed a line, he had reached this low point, and at least responds to that by being like, I have to get help. I need to, like, make changes in my life. Like, that.
Yeah, that never happens in movies.
I mean, seeing a man in therapy in a movie is incredible. Like, you don't see it a lot.
Yeah, but that stuff with the mom and the therapist is really mean. Like, I think it's really cruel.
I don't know. I mean, she's just there to, like, pick him up from this therapy appointment, and maybe she has some boundary issues, but, like, none of that struck me as, like, being that cruel, I guess.
Rebecca is the only person in the movie that doesn't have boundary issues. She's very clear with her boundaries, even with Enid, where she's just like, are we doing this or are we not? And like, stop being a flake.
Yeah,
and
totally.
If you're going to keep being a flake, I can't be in this friendship anymore.
Right, right. Yeah, she's a grown up in that way.
I mean, I guess we don't really know that much about her life, and we don't really know like what the reasons may be for why she is growing up and maturing very differently than her friend.
No, we don't.
But she's the only person in the movie with boundaries. I don't know. Yeah, that friendship felt very... I mean, it's definitely strange, and that, you know, none of us are calling that into question. I just feel like Steve Buscemi's character is lent, even though he doesn't have a happy ending per se, I feel like his, I don't know, the amount of sympathy that the movie extended to him, I thought was strange. Everyone has an unhappy ending, except maybe Rebecca. We don't really know.
Yeah, she goes and she goes to IKEA. She buys her plastic cups. She's working at Starbucks, which brings me to, you know, just a few things that we have to call out in terms of language that gets used, comments that get made that are super reductive. I mean, the R word gets said several times throughout the movie.
Which is very 2001.
Very 2001. You've got your Rebecca saying that a man in the wheelchair doesn't even need that wheelchair, that he's totally just lazy, you know, like making accusations like that. There's some weird, there's like a,
yeah, they're not woke. They're not, they're not woke.
They're definitely not
they're woke. Not woke teens.
No. So just, you know, very of the time. I mean, who was a woke teen in 2001?
Yeah.
Does anyone have any other final thoughts?
I want you guys to ask me more questions, because I think I have such a different like notion of this, but I don't know where to jump in. You know what I mean?
What are your thoughts on it? Like, what are your feelings?
I love it. I think it's an amazing movie. Like, I relate to it so powerfully as a human woman. Like, I think that like Enid is like one of the best characters of all time. I've like, there have been so few times when I've seen myself on screen the way that I see myself with Enid. And I remember, like, even my mom when that came out was like, oh my god, like, that was what you were coming from, like, there was just something. So I think that Enid is such a three-dimensional character. I think her, like, I totally get her. All the stuff that you were saying about them not being woke, like, that's her trying to figure out what funny is, and like trying to be shocking, and like, sure. and then like, you know, kind of pressing the boundaries of it. And then she meets with that like Pat Healy character, who's like in the subculture, but he's a piece of shit because he's got all those anti-Semitic jokes. And she's like, oh wait, no, fuck that guy. That guy sucks. I'm not that guy. Mm-hmm. And she's kind of like dipping her toe into different subcultures. And am I that? Am I that? They live in the suburbs. They live in hell. You know, they like, they decide like one day to like follow the Satanist couple, and like that's a day. Mm-hmm. Or just like, you know, that they're goofing on that stand-up comedian, and they're like, instead of like, that's a loser, they're like, we should marry him. Like,
yeah, they're like, he sucks. Yeah. I want to fuck him.
That shit, there's so much specificity to that I've never seen before. And it's just like, I just think it speaks so, it's like as clear as a bell to like mentally where you are when you are stuck and you are trapped and you and your best friend are going through shit and you don't know what to do. I've just never seen a character like that I've connected with on that level.
Especially because so many teen movies of that era, especially like the late 90s, but even into the, you know, early and mid 2000s, they were these stories that are usually about like a teen girl having some kind of like sex bet against her, or a prom, like, oh, I bet you can't turn this girl into a prom queen, or, you know, some other horribly manipulative thing that often would strip any agency away from the female character, the teen girls. So the fact that this story does give these characters a lot of agency, does explore their interior lives more than a lot of other teen movies were doing. And this movie, these characters subvert some of that stuff.
Yeah, I like that they're like given the space and like agency to like make mistakes, which they do constantly, which is what teenagers do constantly. I like that like one of them has to get a job. You never see that in a teen movie, mm-hmm. where usually it's just like, yeah, it's a lot easier to put a teen movie in an affluent neighborhood so that the plot can just happen and no one has to go do something to survive. Like, there are aspects of this movie that I'm like, you know, it's way more than you're getting from teen movies at this time specifically.
And it's, I think, bigger than a teen movie. The blues hammer scene is super funny.
That I liked that, yeah.
Sure, I just mean like teen movies and it revolves around teenagers.
And I was just gonna say also that like I think it subverts the Bechdel stuff, because when Seymour is like, oh, she's in love with Josh, it's like Enid's head could not be further away from Josh. Mm-hmm. Like, even the fact that, like, Rebecca may or may not be, like, dating him, it doesn't matter. Like, Enid's not thinking about Josh.
No.
Enid's thinking about, like, what the fuck is she going to do? Who the fuck is she? She doesn't have her art scholarship. She, like, doesn't know, you know, where her place in the world is. She has one friend that it's Seymour. She's, like, she talks about being horny as hell and, like, not knowing where to put it. Mm-hmm. And she wants to make this, like, mistake. And then she doesn't know what else to do. But the idea that, like, those two were, you know, and you mentioned before about the two of them talking about Josh. Enid's not jealous because Rebecca's hanging out with Josh. Enid's jealous of Josh.
Right.
Like, she wants to hang out with Rebecca. Seymour is obviously more important. And I love that line when Rebecca's just like, I'm so sick of Seymour.
Yeah.
Because he is getting in the way. And she is seeing her friend disappear. But also, like, I feel like Enid's always been like that and Rebecca's changed, but that's because the movie aligns you with Enid to see from Enid's point of view. That's like, oh, you've changed. You both changed, but the situation has changed.
Mm-hmm.
And to have to figure out what to do with that when the world is like hell and you're trying to choose between, like, oh, like there's this like weird old guy. And I do, there's so many things in that where they're just like so beautifully stated, where he's like, do you like him? Is he a nerd? It's like, well, he is sort of like the exact opposite of everything I hate. You know, just his, like, I do hate sports. And then him in traffic.
Have some more kids, why don't you?
Yeah.
I don't know. Like, I've never really like seen myself quite so vividly on screen as I have in this, especially like from that, I guess, point in my life.
Yeah.
Yeah. I also like the kind of, there's almost this idea of like the inevitability of selling out is something, at least for some of the characters, where like,
yeah,
you know, we have.
Yeah, growing up.
Right. Growing up means to sell out because you have to have a job to support yourself. Yeah. But like there's that one character who she's, I think, buying VHS tapes from or something. And he's really awful to her. And then he says something like, oh, you want to like take down society, go to business school and, you know, work, right, get a job at a corporation and take them down from the inside. That's what I'm gonna do. And like,
that's so 2001 too. That's like that mentality of, mm-hmm, just like,
yeah,
no, participate in capitalism to the fullest extent, and that's how we're gonna get rid of it.
Oh yeah, it's just like so many different shades of nightmare around her. Like, you could be this nightmare person, you could be this horror show.
Mm-hmm. It's so, yeah, there, I don't, I mean, I guess I'm so confused. I like that I kind of appreciate that I'm conflicted about certain aspects of Enid and of Rebecca, because it's like, I respect the hell out of Enid's like commitment to being like, I'm not going to participate in all of this bullshit. And also that the movie pretty clearly illustrates like, well, then you're just going to be pretty lost if you're not willing to have a job,
totally,
if you're
lost,
not willing to put in an effort, and if you're disillusioned with everything,
yeah,
you're left with very few options of how to live your life.
You're fucked. You're broken. You're alone.
And you're also fucked if you do participate, which is what we see through Rebecca, of like, she's playing the game, but she's not totally happy.
Well, I don't know if she's fucked as much as she's just kind of grown up in a specific way that Enid hasn't.
Mm.
You know, that's where she's like, you've changed. It's just that Rebecca can like move forward and Enid can't in that particular way.
Mm-hmm.
She's a different kind of person. They're just different kinds of people.
Sure.
And they met each other's needs for the time that they were together, but it's time to move on. And it's just heartbreaking.
Yeah.
It's heartbreaking.
I, and I just, again, I just wish that the story was more about their characters and their friendship.
You're going to love, yeah, the book.
Yeah.
I'm so excited for you to read the book. I'm serious. It's one of my favorite. I just love these characters so much. I love the book. I love the movie.
And Thora Birch is so great.
She's awesome.
She's amazing.
Yeah.
And she's a teenager playing a teenager, which, mm-hmm, never happened. And like,
there is not a shred of inauthenticity, mm-hmm, to anything she does in that movie.
Mm-hmm.
Even just the way she carries her body, the way she like tries to figure out, like, is this my look now? Like
the green hair, and then someone insults her for the green hair. So then she dyes it back to black.
It's very sad. Yeah. And those moments too were her whole thing that she'll tell you is like, I don't care about fitting in, like, fuck this, blah blah blah, fuck you. But then she is very insecure and very sensitive because teenage, like, it's like she doesn't know who she is. She wants to be accepted somewhere, but if there is pushback,
she's
on
trying to find who she fits with.
Yeah,
she's absolutely, yeah, trying to find a soulmate because she lost so much with Rebecca, mm-hmm, and Seymour's the closest thing. But it can't work.
Can't work.
Sorry.
Can't work. Doesn't work.
Can't work.
Yeah.
So I was interested in, because this is like such a cult classic of like, were there any other endings? Was there studio interference? What was the whole situation there? Mm-hmm. And there was a fair amount. So part of what I found out is that, yeah, Zwigoff was focused on developing the Seymour and Enid storyline, where Klaus focused on the Enid and Rebecca storylines. But I also found out a lot, I guess part of the reason that Rebecca ends up not being in the final script as much is because Thora Birch was, I guess, legally an adult when they were shooting it, and Scarlett Johansson was only 15. So the she's only 15 when this movie is shot, so she like couldn't physically be there as much. So they had to plan around the fact, like, I guess her storyline got pared down partially just logistically, like kids can only be on set for a certain amount of time a day. So
that's wild that they would cast an even younger, because normally they're casting, you know, 29-year-olds to play 18-year-olds. That's wild that they cast someone a few years younger than the character's age. Okay.
In one version of the ending, Zwigoff had Seymour die by suicide at the end of the movie, but that got written out as well. And then the studio, this one made me laugh, that I was like, there has to be a ridiculous studio suggestion. And the studio suggestion was that the movie ends in a double wedding where Enid marries Seymour and Rebecca marries Josh. Which I think was...
That was a studio's pitch?
That was a studio pitch. And then they were just like, absolutely not. Which, good.
That's ludicrous.
Yeah.
So that did make me appreciate at least that, like, I mean, this was not an easy movie to make. It took a long time to get produced, and no one ends happy, which is obviously like, a really unusual thing to be able to get past a studio. Anyways, it's like all these people are deeply flawed and kind of suck in a lot of ways, and no one ends up particularly happy, which is just, you know, uncomfortably close to what real life is like.
Mm-hmm.
So I appreciate that. Yeah. And the double wedding ending suggestion is very funny to me, because what?
What a typical studio note. What a...
I know. They're like, what if they all just got married at the end?
Has a studio ever known what's good for a story or ever known what an audience actually wants? Like, I feel like no.
Yeah, I don't know.
I do want to mention that I disagree with you about the Roberta, the art teacher character. I think that, like, as a comic actress, like, that's like mana from heaven. Like, Ileana Douglas had so much to do. That character's so funny. When she shows that short film, Mirror Father,
Mirror Father.
And then at the end, if you watch the credits, like, her parents are like the producers, and like, it keeps repeating, right, like, her last name. It's like, special thanks to, like, produced. And it's like so clear that, oh, like, yes, her parents funded it. And she's not just like, they're not just taking pot shots at the tampon and a teacup thing. Like, they make fun of that guy, like, with the, who had the like clearly like serial killer that's like, oh it's the mutilator, the, and then it's like, and there's, right, that scene that ends with like, I know that this is Phillips or whatever it is.
Sure.
So like, yeah, there's definitely like a lot of comedy in like those art school scenes that I think are like beyond, you know, just like goofing on feminists.
Sure. A lot of basically all the art gets made fun of. Also just shout out to Mirror Father Mirror, which I'm sure is a feminist text.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I mean, those points about like rich art kid nepotism shit, like, I love that shit. That's like, I wish that it was more focused on that. And Ileana Douglas does an amazing job in that role. I don't know. There's just certain points of it, I'm just like, why, you know, why that aspect?
Well, that brings us to a conversation with friend of the cast, past guest on our Space Jam episode, a brilliant writer, all around terrific person, Princess Weeks. Hello.
Hi, guys. Thank you for having me on again.
Welcome back.
Yes. So we wanted to hear your thoughts, kind of just general thoughts overall about the movie, but to start, just kind of focusing specifically on how you felt the movie handled race.
So terribly. I found it was so weird, because I literally wrote in my notes, the Coons chicken thing is weird AF. Yes. Because it feels so arbitrarily put in there to just give sort of like a third act conflict. to the story and not something that felt very organically put in, especially because the cast itself is so white that it's like there is no black opinion except for that one girl who's like, it's not cool, you know, during the art presentation. And it just feels so ignorant. And there's a larger conversation that could be had about that, because I know just recently we had a conversation about like Aunt Jemima. I know like in Lovecraft Country, which is airing right now, even in the first episode, you see the Aunt Jemima poster in juxtaposition to a bunch of like white kids mocking black people. So there is like a very big history of like racist caricatures in the way that the United States, Canada, UK have done food products, but like Enid is not a character who cares about that kind of stuff, you
exactly
know? She's not even like a Daria type, because I know people have compared like this to Daria, but Daria would actually care. Daria would at least,
she would read
have,
a book
like, the pre she has the pretense of care. She's like, or would at least ask Jody to be like, hey, Jody, do you want to like tag team on this? This just seems like Enid trying to get out of doing a project, which is weird because she already is an artist. So I don't really know why she needs to like literally be like, I found this art and put it in an art show. It's so arbitrary. It's so weird. It's clumsy. And it only serves to put Steve Buscemi's character, Seymour, and Enid in a position of conflict for like 5 minutes. It's really useless.
Yeah, because it's like you said, Enid is this white woman who, as far as we know, doesn't seem to care about racial injustice or racism. She just finds this image and she's like, oh, this will actually help me get a leg up in my art class, because she basically brings it in because her teacher's been saying, you need to be more provocative and political with your art. And she's like, oh, well, this might do that.
Well, and she goes like full like Richard Prince. And she's like, yeah, I didn't do anything. This is someone else's work. But does it make you feel something? Right. Like, it's just, I don't know.
It's so weird because it's like they establish her getting called, you know, anti-Semitic slurs. So it's like, why wouldn't that connect to it? Or why wouldn't she have anything else to pull from it?
Yeah. Because it feels like she brings it in just to, like, show up that other girl in her class who's been bringing in all that provocative art. And it's just like, so you're just...
There's just, like, no real conversation. Like, no... watching certain scenes back, you're just like, does the movie think she's, like... It seems like the movie generally comes down on her side of, like... Yeah, you know what? This was a cool thing to have done. And the art, because the art teacher has already been set up as like this cartoon and has already been set up as like, this is not someone you need to take seriously. Her approval and like, I don't know. It's just, it's such a mess in the way that it's presented. And Princess, like you were saying, there's no black character in this movie who isn't an unnamed student or an unnamed parent to like provide any sort of comment on this that would be relevant. Like, it's just so bizarre. I don't know.
Sometimes you watch a movie and you're like, this is 2000s. And like, you know, I was like, ooh, first 4 minutes, we get an R word. We get some casual ableism in how we frame characters.
Yeah. What?
You know, like just, I feel like it's just so hard because like, she's always saying these weird homophobic things. Like when she's like, oh yeah, we're going to have to get checked for AIDS after this girl gets date raped. I'm just like, what is this for? And it feels so of that era. You know what? This movie made me think of two movies that I felt like, Booksmart and Jennifer's Body. Because Booksmart, I think, is very much like the like great, great, great grand aunt of like, it, like, you know, the descendant of this kind of film. Because it's like two women who are like not popular, but still interact. But I think Booksmart, again, because it's, you know, written by women, I believe, directed by a woman. It's like you get more of this intimacy of like a friendship. Like, when it comes down to it, Edith spends more time with Steve Buscemi than she does with Rebecca. So I really have no context for why they're friends, besides they're both just mean. And that's not a personality. And it's like, with Jennifer's Body, you know, which is, again, written, directed by women, not a perfect film in terms of, like, the dialogue. A lot of the dialogue is very dated. But you get, like, a very intimate look at the friendship and tension between these two girls going into these different transitions in their life. Like, there's just not enough time spent with these two young girls transitioning to this new phase of life for me to feel like this is, like, really about them. Like, I did not realize how much Steve Buscemi was going to be in this movie, because, like, all you ever see is, like, Scarlett Johansson and Enid. And I'm just like, but it's not about them. And I found that to be really disappointing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was curious about your feelings on that friendship, too, because we have had, I mean, like, a lot of discussion about that as well of, like, I, you know, when I was younger, I definitely had friends with older people, but it was, I don't know, just the gray areas of that relationship, that there's endless discussion, but I was curious on what your take on that was.
It's like, I have like two brains about it. Like, I have like, honestly, like my feminist brain, and then I have like my just storytelling brain. And like, as a storytelling device, I think that it's handled in a way that I think is as respectful as it can be for something so like odd. Like, I think that they do a good job of not having Seymour be predatory in like how he treats Enid. I feel like for the most part throughout their relationship, he's very respectful of Enid. Like, he, and even with Dana, when he's like, stopped hanging out with her, I'm like, he's doing a lot of the right things, but my feminist brain has a problem with it, because then it's putting all of the autonomy of instigating the sexual relationship on Enid, who is like 18 max,
right?
Because she just graduated high school, who is like drinking, who is like, I feel like there's like, it's Steve Buscemi's character who should be setting these boundaries.
Yes.
Like, when Dana comes in and is like, why are you friends with someone this young? It's a legitimate question, you know, like, why are you friends with someone this young? And like, I can't, like, I've had relationships with much older men, and like, do I think that all of them were correct? No. And I think that it's one of those things where if it was like, this was something that she did, and we had more time to even spend with her being like, I regret it. I rushed into this thinking that I was being empowered, but I really wasn't, because I'm just with him because I need to feel something with somebody. That would be interesting. But instead, because Steve Buscemi like gets fired and he's sad about it, it becomes all about her having to go and say like, I think that you're great, you're my hero. And I'm like, girl, what? I just, it becomes all about her uplifting him and like making him feel better. That like, even the things that could be interesting about exploring this relationship between them is really limited because it's all about him.
Yeah.
It is like a very bizarre treatment of the, I don't know, like we sort of discussed kind of the mindset you're talking about, like being both minds about it, of like, it doesn't make, I don't know. This movie is difficult.
Yeah. And I think also, like you said, like, it's not, there are so many things in the movie where I'm like, if we could just spend more time with Enid in this moment, it would be so much more meaningful. I think, like, she spends all this time trying to get Seymour a date, which, girl, why? I don't understand.
Why?
And then, like, he does with someone who she doesn't approve of, and then instantly she's, like, jealous. But she doesn't do... Why does it have to default to you having sex with a much older man? Like, why does it have to... Why can't you just go on that bus without having to cross that line? Or maybe even, does it just be a kiss? Why does it have to be sex? You know, like, why does it have to be that thing, which, like, and have it be her who's, like, not even discuss it, just like, oh, I rushed into this, and he's like, so you're gonna move in with me, and it frames him to be the victim.
Yeah.
In so much of that, and I'm not saying that he's a villain, but I am saying that he is old enough to have better judgment about what this relationship is, you know, like, even if they are going to have sex, I think he really genuinely believes that she's going to move in with him, or that he's going to break up with his, like, appropriate girlfriend to be, like, you know what I mean? It's just like,
you do just, I'm like, I do wish that she had someone in her life to talk to who wasn't Steve Buscemi in this moment. And then the Steve Buscemi character, I don't know, I feel like there's a lot of, even, like, the details around Steve Buscemi's character where, you know, Seymour is like, you know, I don't think an aggressively bad person, but he gets away with a lot, including kind of ending up with this victim narrative when he is friends with a teenage girl and needs to be the adult in this situation. And then in the same way, when he is like, I don't know, just the way that he is like, he has this racist art at his house. He loves black music and is like hanging out with all his old guy white friends and there's no self-awareness around that. There's no real accountability applied to him in terms of like, well, if you know you're working for such a racist company, why, you know, why? And right. and that was another thing that it seems like the movie might try to like attempt to address, probably not well, but attempt, but then it's just kind of dropped of like, well, he just has this and it's just a thing he has,
right? And it's the same thing with like when Enid brings the art in and she's trying to justify why she thinks it's this like profound piece of art, and she really stumbles through her answer and gives what's essentially a non-answer, but her white art teacher was like, this is remarkable. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, okay, is the intent of this movie to show how cavalier white people tend to be about racism? But I'm like, if that is the intention, it's, again, it's so poorly handled because we're only seeing this through white characters' perspectives. Like, the couple black characters you see who are, like, protesting at the little gallery show, or, like, the character who is credited as black student in the art classroom is just like, hey, that it's not right. And that's the only perspective you get on it from any black people. And it's just like, ugh.
So much of this stuff that we're talking about apparently is not what the graphic novel includes.
Right. No, there's not a lot of Steve Buscemi.
Yeah, he's not in it a lot. It is much more about Enid and Rebecca's friendship. Mm-hmm. So things that make you go, to quote Lindsay, is like, why is it when you made this movie about these two teenage girls going through this, you know, transitional space, did it all of a sudden have to have, like, a male character have such a giant role in this film? Like, that's sus to me. Like, mm-hmm. And after reading that, I was, like, even more disappointed. Because you can tell at the beginning that there's supposed to be these elements of, like, how close they are together. Like, from what I've read, there's definitely more discussion about them being perceived as queer together. And I'm, like, oh, yeah, that's definitely there. They don't explore it at all.
Mm-hmm. Rebecca's barely there.
Like, yeah, she's barely there. And there's supposed to be this whole issue of, like, Rebecca being the attractive one that everyone wants. And it's just, like, they don't really do anything with it. There's supposed to be this whole thing with Josh. They don't do anything with that. So it just feels like a lot of missteps in attempts to make mm-hmm. it more, I don't know, cynical, male-focused. Like, it feels like they're like, we need a guy to sell this movie. And they're like, let's get Steve Buscemi.
Right.
And it's like, I can tell that this movie, because it is very beloved. And I can see that, because I think that any time that a movie comes out, like, with two teenage girls where they're just very mad, it's because, like, usually, you know, it's like the Mean Girls or the Cluelesses. And it's like, oh, yeah, finally a movie for the other kinds of girls. But I hate that dichotomy anyway.
Yeah, is there anything else you wanted to touch on?
No, I remember, like, when they sleep together, I, like, wrote on my iPad. I was like, underline, 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 underline. I was so, like, gobsmacked. I really wish I enjoyed it more, because I think that the performances are really good. Like, I actually like Scarlett Johansson in the movie. Wow. Surprise. Mm-hmm. But she was really, I thought she was good in this. I actually liked her character more. I thought Steve Buscemi was, you know, very good. Like, he was, I really connected to his performance. It made me, like, probably enjoy Seymour much more than I would have otherwise.
The last thing I wanted to share, so I read this piece by my friend Megan Keister. She wrote a profile on Terry Zwigoff a couple of years ago in 2017. And she includes a picture of Thora Birch and Scarlett Johansson in Ghost World, and they, like, wrote a little message to Terry Zwigoff, and you know, interpret as you will, but Scarlett Johansson, who is 15 when this movie came out, or 16, mm-hmm. She writes next to her name, "Terry, as much as I would like to think you wouldn't, please don't hang this picture on your bedroom ceiling, Scarlett." Oh. So, you know, for everyone's consideration.
Jesus. There is that scene where, like, David Cross's character is, like, hitting on her, and I'm like, she's obviously a child. Like,
truly. Yeah. I was equally like jump scare to see David Cross in this movie as I was jump scare to see Bob Odenkirk in Little Women. Like, you just don't see either of them coming. You're like, whoa!
Him?
The twist!
Oh my gosh. Well, thank you for joining us, Princess.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Special little segment. We'll return to the regularly scheduled episode. But first, where can people follow you online and check out your stuff?
So they can follow me at Weeks Princess on Twitter, and they can find my YouTube channel, Melina Pendulum, as well.
Well, thank you again so much. And
yeah, we'll talk to you soon.
Back to the episode. So as far as the Bechdel test goes, it does pass handily.
It does.
Mostly between Enid and Rebecca. There's also just a lot of different combinations of characters, female characters speaking to each other. But let's put it to our nipple scale. So a nipple scale of 0 to 5 nipples.
What is this?
This is the Bechdel cast nipple scale. So 0 to 5 nipples based on how the movie fares from an intersectional feminist lens. So on one hand, you do have a different version of teen girls than we have seen prior to this in most movies geared towards teenagers and young adults. So I think there's a lot of value in that. I do see how relatable Enid is for a lot of people, me included. Both Enid and Rebecca. Like, I saw parts of myself in Enid and in Rebecca, and maybe even Josh. You know, I also was making ice cream for children as a teenager. So, you know.
And just like teenagers torturing each other at their jobs is a very universal experience. Yeah.
Because I have no nostalgia or attachment to this movie, and I'm coming at it strictly from the lens of really just having, like, seeing it as a young person only that one time, and then watching it through my current lens, it's really, I'm able to sort of separate things in a different way than someone who did grow up with this movie and does have more of an attachment to it, I guess. And that's just sort of the nature of what this show is like.
Got it.
How does the media we saw as young people, how did that affect us? How did that affect culture at large? You know, all that kind of stuff. So, like,
I'm like, yeah, what is it like to revisit it? And
right. So with all of that in mind, that plus the things that I take a big issue with, which is the way it really mishandles the racist art component of the story, the fact that there is a sexual relationship between these two characters who have such an enormous disparity in their emotional maturity. And yes, you could make the argument that Seymour is not the most emotionally mature man in his 40s ever. But, like, he has a better sense of who he is. He knows what he likes. He has established an adult life for himself, whereas Enid is still figuring out who she is and what she wants. And again, she's just so newly out of high school. She has not lived as an adult, and her emotional maturity is still developing. And the whole situation just gave me a lot of pause and just made me overall feel pretty uncomfortable. So with all that in mind, I guess I would give it, for me, it just kind of goes right down the middle, like a 2.5 nipples is what I will give it. And we also award our nipples. So if you'd like to do that, that is an option to you. So I will give one of my nipples to Enid, one to Rebecca, and I will give one to the art teacher.
To Roberta?
Yeah, Roberta gets a half. I'll go 2.5 on this one as well. Yeah, I like how much agency the characters have. I like how much they fuck up. I like they're like trying to fit in, failing to fit in, trying to fit in again. Like, all of that is so, like, I feel like almost any teen girl could see parts of themselves in that process of trying on a personality. Oh, this isn't working. Fuck this. I'm going to try this. And all that is so cool and universal and I think well told. And I feel like the Seymour relationship could be a component of that, of like, here is that it, that is sort of like a friendship, you know, Enid is trying that friendship on, saying, is this where I belong? but then it just ends up taking up so much space in a way that I'm like, I would have rather have seen her continue to have that like kind of pinball struggle instead of really honing in on this one relationship and friendship. I just kind of wish that they had chosen a different target to stay focused on.
Sure.
There. So
I have so much compassion for adolescents. I swear to God, like the way that your brain grows and at what rate and the hormones, like I really do. I have so much compassion for people mm-hmm. like who are going through that phase of life.
And showing that discomfort is like really powerful. Oh,
it's so challenging. It's so challenging.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think we as humans are all permanently traumatized by our adolescence.
Oh, right? For sure.
Yeah,
for sure.
Except for people like Melora, and that's why you're like, oh, fuck off, Melora. Why are you so goddamn chipper? Oh, Melora. Also, Melora, how do you not know we don't like you? All we're doing is being bitchy. You've never once gotten the hint. Hey, guys, we should hang out sometime. Melora.
She's not perhaps the most self-aware.
She's no, not a shred of self-awareness about her.
No. Laura, move forward.
But yeah, there's like the focus on, I mean, kind of similar to you, Caitlin. I think that the way that they treat race in this movie is very weird and doesn't. This was not a movie where they could have handled that responsibly without bringing in other people, which they didn't. And so that whole storyline, to the point where like the only black characters who speak are kind of made to seem oversensitive for being unhappy with the choices that Enid is making. So they're like
race stuff on it. Zero nipples.
Really bad.
Negative. Yeah. Nipples.
Yeah. So I'm going to go 2.5 as well. Yeah, one to Enid, one to Rebecca, and a half to the girl who put the tampon in the cup.
Tampon
good
in
for
a
her. Good for her.
Good for her.
Julie, how about you?
I don't know. I give it one me at 18.
Okay. Fair enough.
How's that? Yeah.
Well, Julie, thank you so much for being here. What an interesting discussion this movie has spawned.
I know.
Yes. And thank you for continuing to challenge, you know, my ideas about intersectional feminism and to, you know, give me things to think about and other people things to think about. And, you know, generationally, I'm just very appreciative of all approaches to, you know, feminism and just thinking about things the way I haven't been conditioned to. And I really appreciate those insights to kind of like throttle me from my little comfort seat of things that I've believed since I was, you know, I just appreciate the more conversation, the better. So
yeah, it's a journey. It's a journey that there's things we have to learn. There's things we have to unlearn. It's a process. So we're right there with you.
Yeah.
Yeah. But good luck with those De Palma movies. Yeah. Wow. Wow. Wee. Wow.
Might be a while till we return.
Good luck.
There.
Ooh, yeah. De Palma.
There's no urgency. Where can people follow you? Check out your stuff. Plug away.
I am on Twitter, unfortunately.
Yes.
Listen to Double Thread. It's a podcast I do with Tom Sharpling, and subscribe, and it's really fun, and I do that every week. And then I created a show called Difficult People that I co-star in with Billy Eichner, and all of those are on Hulu, so I'm very proud of those.
You can follow us on social media at BechdelCast. You can subscribe to our Patreon, aka Matreon, which is $5 a month, and it gets you 2 bonus episodes every month, plus access to the entire back catalog of bonus episodes. That's available at patreon.com/BechdelCast. We've also got our merch at tpublic.com/TheBechdelCast. You can get shirts, pillows, masks, even all kinds of stuff. Also, thanks again to Princess Weeks for joining us for that special segment. Be sure to check out her work and follow her on social media as well. And